This presentation is a broad survey of the history of nonviolence in the United States. It begins in the early 17th century, although Native Americans obviously contributed to this history as well. I'm beginning more with the early European settlements, and it will survey the tradition from the 17th century to the present. And I'll be talking about men and women who have made contributions to our understanding of this concept. It's been a very gradual understanding, and we're still working to understand the full implications of what nonviolence is all about. A working definition might be that nonviolence is a method, a means, a philosophy. It's a strategy for resisting injustice, resolving conflict, and bringing about social change without killing, without harming people. There have been people from many, many nationalities and backgrounds who have contributed to this history. And oftentimes, as I said, it's a gradual understanding. That is, it's a kind of unfolding. We still don't have a very good word to name the concept. Nonviolence is not a very good word in English. As you know, Gandhi had a better word, satyagraha, meaning truth force. But we still have nonviolence, and that's what we're working with. But it's important to remember that in using the term nonviolence that we're talking about nonviolent action. Now, the men and women who have been involved themselves sometimes did not fully understand the concept and the experiments that they were involved in. As you remember, that Gandhi also talked about experiments with truth. And so these people are experimenting constantly. And some of them were not philosophically committed to nonviolence. That is, but they, in spite of that fact, they contributed a lot to our understanding of the theory and also the strategies of nonviolence. And we're very fortunate at the present time because we have a person and a whole series of scholars and researchers now who've helped us enormously. The key name is Gene Sharp, who published his classic work in 1973. Called The Politics of Nonviolent Action, and has been continuing to write about that. And as a result of his work, his naming of 198 methods and so on, we really understand the concept much better. He's relied, of course, on all of these people to come to that understanding. But we do owe him a lot, and his work with the American, with the Institute in Boston, the Albert Einstein Institute, has been extremely important. This is a very important icon of the history of nonviolence. It's a painting by Edward Hicks, a great Quaker painter, done in the early 19th century. He painted something like 40 versions of this painting. We have a wonderful version at the Worcester Art Museum, where I live in Worcester, Massachusetts. But I'm interested in a lot of things in this painting because, first of all, you can see that the concept comes from Isaiah, from the Old Testament. That is, that we look forward to that time when all of nature will live in harmony, when the lion will lie down with the lamb, and people will be integrated with the environment, and so on. And there's so much in that painting. But I'm particularly interested in, over on the left-hand side, the sort of political, really political aspects of the painting. And because there you see gathered together in a circle men and women talking together. The fact that they're in a circle means that everybody is treated as an equal. And there are Native Americans there. And one of the people at the center is William Penn. William Penn, an Englishman whose father, quote, gave him Pennsylvania. It wasn't his land to give, but as you know, that was what was happening when England owned the world. And he gave his son this land that we now call Pennsylvania. And William Penn came to this country, but before he came here, very important, he wrote to the Native Americans and said, "We come to live with you in peace." Now, that was not the disposition of many of the people who came, for example, to Massachusetts, where the Native Americans were rounded up and put in concentration camps and warred against and so on. But William Penn actually said this, and so when the Quakers came to Pennsylvania, they were already committed to what is called the Peaceable Kingdom. That's the title of this painting. And William Penn would carry that out, and he's really a very important figure in this whole history. Now, this is the hope that has brought so many people to the United States, and in fact, still bringing people to the United States, who come here as refugees, perhaps from authoritarian governments or from poverty or whatever. This has been the hope, to live together in peace and in harmony. This is the hope. The reality is something quite different. The reality is that we are the major supplier of armaments to the world. Our military budget is $500 billion a year. And we know with $500 billion that we could feed, clothe, educate, and provide health care for every person in the world for several years. The economics on this have been done by the Development Office of the United Nations. So here is what we have become. We have become an empire. We have become a militarist country where our resources, the talent of our people, are going into making nuclear weapons. Not only that, but we're then making weapons, other weapons that we sell to anybody and everybody who has the money to buy them. It's even worse than during the Cold War in terms of the free access and the easy access to armaments from the United States. It's a sad story. But we must remember that in the midst of this, in the midst of this development of empire and the imperial disposition that leads us to economically and militarily dominate the world, that there have been other people who had a different version of what the United States might be, would be. And Thomas Paine is one of them, shown here. The author of Common Sense, born in England in 1737. He came to the U.S. In 1774. Only 2 years before the Declaration of Independence. He actually came here, he was asked to come here by Benjamin Franklin, who wanted him to come to set up a school for women in Philadelphia. But Paine already had some experience as an organizer. He'd done some important labor organizing in England. And even before he got off the boat, he began to practice his skill as an organizer and a pamphleteer. He was an extraordinary writer. I mean, He's the great pamphleteer in English. His only competition is maybe Arundhati Roy at the present moment, who is almost as good as Thomas Paine. I hope you know her pamphlets and her great work, Arundhati Roy from India. Anyway, Paine is such a fascinating figure, and he wrote Common Sense in 1776. It was published in January of that year. And what he did in that amazing piece of writing is to bring together arguments for independence that had been around. There had been something like 300 pamphlets since the early 18th century advocating independence for the American colonies. But he brought them together in a very readable form, and it really led many people then to the cause for independence. His essential argument was, look, you guys, what's going on here? Connecticut is in conflict with Georgia, and South Carolina is in conflict with Massachusetts. Get your act together. Your foe is the empire, is the English. Get them off your back. That's where your priorities should be. And of course, it was immensely successful in its readership. And shortly afterward, Thomas Jefferson would take many of the arguments from Common Sense and write them in even more elegant language in the Declaration of Independence, which is, of course, a very central document, not only to U.S. history, but to the history of nonviolence as well. This is the motto of Thomas Paine: my country is the world, to do good is my religion. And this is an important concept that is going to occur over and over and over again in the history of nonviolence in the U.S. My country is the world. The sense of it being that we owe our allegiance not just to our neighbors in Greenfield or Worcester or Boston. We owe our allegiance to the people of the world, and that we should be as concerned about the people in South Africa or Iraq or Bangladesh as we are about our neighbors who live next door. My country is the world, to do good is my religion. And Paine was a wonderful troublemaker. He was always getting people so excited because he then took on religion because he thought that religion was in such a terrible state, it was going to fall into superstition. And of course, when he did that, then he was attacked as being an atheist. Who was it? Teddy Roosevelt called him a filthy little atheist. He was no more an atheist than John Henry Newman was. I mean, he was a deist, and his religion, as he said, to do good is my religion. That his religion was to do good, that is, in faith and practice, not in belief. But my country is the world. You'll hear that repeated by in slightly different language by everyone from Eugene Victor Debs to Martin Luther King up to the present moment. It's a very important concept to this. Now, during the Revolution, the time period of the Revolution and the struggle for independence, there are many examples of nonviolence, successful nonviolence. That is, people who were initiating social change, but without harming others. They were doing it by resolving conflict and by pursuing justice, but in a way that was not going to kill. And here is one of the, this is the most famous incident, I suppose, and that's the Boston Tea Party. The British taxed the American colonists. That was the way of keeping their thumb on them, taxed their tea. So these people, disguising themselves as Native Americans, went onto the boat, very practical, good idea, took the tea and dumped it in the harbor. If it was Dan and Phil Berrigan, they might have said, as Dan and Phil Berrigan did in 1968, some property has no right to exist. Because property, when it represents oppression, when it is oppression, then it shouldn't exist, because property is for people. So this was a very successful, but there were many others. There were many other efforts of organizing in such a way. In Massachusetts, for example, there was a governor who was really kind of thrown out by nonviolent resistance. And for a long time, people thought those were just random kind of actions. But we know now, through the scholarship of the Albert Einstein Institution and elsewhere, these were carefully planned, that these people had a plan. And that's the most important thing in nonviolence, a goal that they wanted to achieve and the means by which they were going to do it. So that's very important. And their example was important to many other people. There were others, of course, when the revolution was accomplished, you might say, or at least when we became independent, who said, oh, well, I'm not satisfied with this. We had other goals in mind. We had other things we were trying to achieve. Benjamin Rush, who is quoted here, was a Quaker doctor, a very fascinating person, who said, the American War is over, but this is far from the case with the American Revolution. On the contrary, only the first act of the great drama is at a close. And what he meant by that, he was well aware, because the Quakers had begun to refuse to participate in slavery. There were horrible injustices in the new country. Slavery was legal. 6 or 7 of the first presidents owned slaves. So there was this terrible injustice. And so he said, oh, wait, no, the revolution has not been accomplished. We have many things we have to do. And that was a theme that was in the lives of a number of people at the time of the revolution and afterward. And one of the great figures in the early 19th century who made this a really rallying cry was William Lloyd Garrison, shown here. Born in Newburyport, Massachusetts, he was from a very conservative Baptist family. But he'd learned to be a printer, and he went to Boston to practice his trade. Then decided at one point that he would go to Baltimore. And when he got to Baltimore, he went down near the port, and he was just horrified because he saw slavery. He saw people being taken into slavery. He saw husbands taken from their wives, children taken from family and sent to slavery. He could have seen that in New England as well. It just happened that he had to go to Baltimore to have it, you know, confront him. So he rushed onto the ship to stop them, and of course he was arrested. Slavery was legal. So he was put in jail, but when he was released, he returned to Boston, and there he became the center of the abolitionist movement. Now there are many other things I'm not mentioning that are part of this history too, the slave rebellions that took place, for example, and many, many other figures, and Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth and all these other great people, but I just am mentioning selected figures, and he's important because he started not only a movement, but smart man, started a newspaper called The Liberator. And notice the motto, my country is the world's, my countrymen are all mankind. See, there it is again. My country is the world. And somebody said, oh, you're just repeating Thomas Paine. He said, oh, I didn't know that. So you see, that's what I mean by a tradition. These sentiments were in the air. There was a lot of times they simply were not used as a basis for organization. But here he picks it up and my country is the world. My countrymen are all mankind. Now the language, of course, is sexist. It sounds sexist to us, but actually he was a great feminist, and there are many stories to justify that. In fact, that's why I'm sure that so many great women were drawn to the abolitionist movement, in part because of William Lloyd Garrison, not to mention Frederick Douglass, who escaped from slavery at 19 and came to Boston so he could meet William Lloyd Garrison, and then went out to Rochester, New York, where he started his own newspaper called North Star. This is, as I said, sort of a quick survey, but I think it's important when I say that William Lloyd Garrison was a feminist. For example, he went to New York at one of the huge anti-slavery meetings in New York, and there was a big debate as to whether or not women would be allowed to be on the board, you know, to be governing. And they said, oh no, women can't be on the board. So he just broke up the meeting and went and started another anti-slavery movement, another anti-slavery group. And of course, among the marvelous people who were drawn to this work through him, here she is, Abigail Kelly Foster, born in Pelham, Massachusetts in 1811. She was an Irish Quaker. She and her family moved to Worcester then, and she eventually went to school in Providence. There was a Quaker school where she could study to be a teacher. Women were not allowed at the university at this time, of course. But she studied to be a teacher in Providence and later went to teach in Lynn, Massachusetts. While she was in Lynn, she went to Faneuil Hall and she heard William Lloyd Garrison speak. And that was it. She said, I must give my life to the abolitionist movement, which she did. She became the editor of the Anti-Slavery Bugle. She spoke all over the country. She was an extraordinary speaker. In fact, her husband, this is Stephen Simons Foster, said that she was the greatest speaker he ever heard, and she apparently was extraordinary. And you can imagine what was said about her when she went. First of all, she did all kinds of scandalous things. She traveled not only with black women, but also with black men. Scandalized everybody. And there's a great report in the newspaper of her speech in New Haven, Connecticut. And the reporter, you can tell, was really quite taken with her and thought she was quite an amazing speaker. But of course, as a woman, she couldn't use logic, the reporter said. But she trapped them with her feminine wiles. So she had a lot of things at her disposal, but she traveled all over the country, and you should read the letters between her and her husband. They're very, very moving, because it was difficult. He stayed at home and took care of their daughter while she went out, you know, as far as Chicago in abolitionist meetings, because she became very well known. Her motto was, go where you are least wanted, for there you are most needed. And Stephen pursued her for a long time, but she didn't, kind of kept him at a distance. But finally, she agreed to marry him. And they, of course, didn't have a minister because, you know, they married one another. They didn't need any interference from clergy. And he had a wonderful background, too. He'd gone to Dartmouth. And while he was at Dartmouth, he got into trouble because he wouldn't participate in military drills. So they put him in jail, and he got to jail, and he started prison reform. And so he is just, and all these people have their richness of their lives is so extraordinary and so marvelous. They were so deeply human. And they lived in Worcester, where the center of the abolitionist movement. Worcester has a very great social history. It's where the Free Soil Party began. The Worcester mayor at one point announced that the whole city of Worcester would never prosecute the fugitive slave law. Just imagine, the mayor commits civil disobedience. Wouldn't that be great if the mayor of Greenfield did that about nuclear weapons and all kinds of other things? Anyway, he's a very fascinating figure, and he wrote a very popular pamphlet in the 1850s, the title of which is The Brotherhood of Thieves, or a true picture of the American church and clergy. It went through 20 editions. And he also even went so far, his dedication to nonviolence is indicated by a famous incident when a federal marshal came to Worcester to return a slave to his master, as was supposed to happen according to national law. Well, the people in Worcester circled the hotel, and it looked like the federal marshal was really in trouble. So he stood between the angry crowd and the federal marshal so they could get him back on the stage and send him back to Boston, unharmed, you see. Nonviolence at its greatest. So fascinating. And they, of course, were the center. I'm mentioning, again, isolated cases, but they were parts of a huge community of people committed to abolitionism and many others that I'm sure you're familiar with, like Sojourner Truth, who helped to liberate thousands and thousands of people from slavery. I've already mentioned William Lloyd Garrison and William Douglas, who escaped from slavery. And the issues were these. This is in the 1840s. And the issues were linked because in the 1846, the U.S. entered into its first major imperial war, that is, the Mexican War. And that was to seize territory, which we did, because much of the land that we have, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, that was land that belonged to the to Mexico. And so there was a war declared, and there was a very strong anti-war movement. They never told us that in history, but in fact, the whole Massachusetts delegation, congressional delegation, the whole delegation voted against the Mexican War. Now, did you ever hear that in your high school history or college history? No, they don't tell you, because this history is buried. Once a culture embraces violence, you see, it destroys any alternatives to itself. And so all of this rich history remains really to be discovered and rediscovered over and over again. But here's where they joined the two issues. People saw clearly that this was also an attempt by the pro-slavery people in the U.S. to extend the nation south, because those states would then come in as slave states. And of course, there were great battles over this. A lot of people from Massachusetts, as you know, moved to Kansas so that when Kansas voted for statehood, that it would come in as a free state, not as a slave state. So this is how all this is a terrifically complex and interesting. We should remember that in the peace movement, how extensive it is, that peacemaking ultimately is much more complicated than war making. It has to involve people at every level doing all kinds of different things in order to help to build the community. Here's the anti-slavery pledge. Solemnly pledge ourselves not to countenance or aid the U.S. government in any war which may be occasioned by the annexation of Texas or in any other war, foreign or domestic, designed to strengthen or perpetuate slavery. You see, they saw war and injustice as linked. It's the link that Martin Luther King would make in 1967 in his great speech at Riverside Church. He saw the Vietnam War as a racist war. He saw that as part of the whole struggle. It's very interesting, historically. And of course, there were people who went to jail because they were opposed to that Mexican War. And one of them was Henry David Thoreau, shown here. Fortunately, he refused to pay his poll tax that was to pay for the war and spent the night in jail. It was a very important incident. Putting people in jail is sometimes a mistake because they many times will come out much more radical than they were when they went in. And we owe this, this experience. Out of this experience, then he wrote what is one of the most famous documents in this history, Civil Disobedience, which didn't even appear in book form until after his death. But Civil Disobedience, about the majority of one, about marching to a different drummer. All those wonderful, wonderful statements of Thoreau as to how democracy works. It works when people stand up for principle, even if you're the only one. And it's a document, of course, that has been translated all over the world, was extremely important to Gandhi, was cited by the people, the Danes, during this Second World War, in their resistance to Hitler. So these are the documents that have not only importance for us, but also for the rest of the world. Among many statements, he says at one point, if 1,000 people were not to pay their tax bill this year, that would not be as violent and bloody a measure as it would be to pay them and enable the state to commit violence and shed innocent blood. If you want to stop the war in Iraq, stop paying your taxes. Once the government has the money, they make more nuclear weapons. Every one of us, I'm sad to say, including me, every year, $1,500 of my taxes go to build nuclear weapons that I'm totally opposed to. It just makes you want to weep when you think that your money is going to build those weapons and all this war making. But Thoreau said what one must do. And Allen Ginsberg would pick up that theme much later during the Vietnam War. Certainly, as I said, among many other figures, Walt Whitman is extremely important. He was a very strong abolitionist and publishes Leaves of Grass in 1855. This is probably the single most important work in American literature. He had been fired from his job as an editor of the Brooklyn Eagle because of an editorial he wrote opposing slavery. So we ended up wandering around with odd jobs, working here and there, sometimes as a teacher, sometimes as a woodworker or whatever, but it was too bad for him. But luckily for us, that's how he spent his life, because that whole life on the city streets of New York becomes Leaves of Grass, which is absolutely unbelievable he discovered American language, among other things. And he is certainly a part of this history. In fact, he has wonderful poem at the beginning of Leaves of Grass, to the cities and the states, resist much, obey little, he says. Once unquestioning obedience, once fully enslaved. So his father had known Thomas Paine, he admired Thomas Paine, and would often, Whitman would speak on the anniversary of Paine. So that's where the tradition comes in. This is Elihu Burritt from New Britain, Connecticut. You'll see his name on the library at the Connecticut State University there. Fascinating figure, who was a working man and decided he was going to go to Boston. Started out from New Britain, walking, but he got as far as Worcester, and he discovered the American Antiquarian Society there, and he could use their books. And in the process discovered he had a kind of genius for language. And he wrote elementary grammars for Sanskrit and Armenian. But all the time very devoted as both an abolitionist and as a worker. He eventually is nominated for vice president on the working men's ticket. And this man circulated petitions all over this country and Western Europe, where people said and promised they would never take up arms against their brothers and sisters again. So he's a very important figure in the history of nonviolence, and so much to be said about him. But one of the most important is that he's the co-founder of what is probably the first international peace society in the world. He co-founded it with his friend Aidan Ballou, shown here. Aidan Ballou was a universalist minister, very popular minister who used to speak in Boston and New York, and he was the co-founder of the Hopedale community in Hopedale, Massachusetts. An anarchist, actually, well, anarchist socialist, but a very good writer whose autobiography I recommend. But he is also extremely important as the author of what is perhaps the first extended discussion of nonviolence as a strategy. It was called Christian Non-Resistance, and it was published in 1846. 1846. This is 50 years before Gandhi is struggling with many of the same questions, looking at it and from a different perspective, but nonetheless, it's all, again, a part of this tradition. And Aidan Ballou, there's a statue to him in Hopedale, and there is a Friends of Aidan Ballou now, but this man should be very widely known. He was read, Tolstoy read his work. In fact, Tolstoy translated his pamphlets. Remember, after Tolstoy had the kind of conversion and dedicated himself to nonviolence, he turned all of his talent as a novelist to writing these incredible pamphlets on nonviolence. And he quotes Aidan Ballou at length and says in the preface, "Why do you in the United States not know your great figures of nonviolence?" So this is still an important book, Aidan Ballou. He lived from 1801 to 1890. He's a most extraordinary figure and a delight to read. Lucy Stone from West Brookfield, Massachusetts. By tradition, the first woman to speak from a pulpit in Massachusetts, in Gardner. She had gone to Mount Holyoke for a year, but then transferred to Oberlin, because Oberlin at that point had quite a reputation as being a center for abolitionism. And she got there, and of course, one of the first things she did was to arrange for Abigail Kelly and Stephen Simons Foster to speak. Well, that was too much for Oberlin. They said, "Oh no, we're against slavery, but we don't want those rabble-rousers on campus." So resourceful, she got a local church, and they spoke there. And Lucy Stone then, of course, devoted much of her life to the abolitionist movement, but decided at one point, she said, "I'm going to give Monday through Friday to abolitionism, but Saturday and Sunday will go to the women's movement." And she became an editor of the Women's Journal, an extraordinary figure whose daughter then was a very important feminist in the early 20th century. And just to suggest, I say from time to time that it's tradition, but these friendships, these communities are so important because she knew Abigail Kelly. And when Abigail Kelly Foster died, she wrote in the Women's Journal, "Abigail Kelly Foster cleared a path across which many women walked to freedom." Her sister-in-law was the first woman to receive a medical degree in the United States, and her husband was a great feminist as well. In the late 19th century, the workers' movement really began to organize. There had been the Molly Maguires, and there had been others resisting, people of horrendous capitalists and so on, but they discovered their strength was in numbers. And the issues, of course, were very serious. Child labor was common. These young girls, 8, 9, and 10, working in canneries, many of them would die by the time they were 26 because of the conditions under which they were working. And these boys, too, going down into mines, no protection, fires, cave-ins, of course, no compensation, very, very dangerous. So people took up their cause to end child labor. Here are the Wobblies, industrial workers of the world, the IWW, very, very skilled organizers and very such fascinating people. Not formally educated, but extremely smart. This is one of their posters that went throughout the country. They had songs. Joe Hill wrote songs for them that they'd sing on the picket line when they were arrested and thrown in prison. And one of their many causes was the abolition of child labor, which eventually they were successful in eradicating. And other people, part of this a wider community. Emma Goldman, born in Russia, came to New York in about 1894. She lived in Rochester, New York, and she had worked in the factories in Russia. She got to the U.S., again, coming here with the promise of a better life, and she said, "My Lord, the working conditions here are worse than they are in Russia." And so she became a labor organizer, but then devoted much of her attention to the women's movement. She saw the plays of Ibsen and Strindberg, and she wrote about them in Atlantic Monthly, and she was a very good writer. And I hope you know her autobiography, And all of her pamphlets really are absolutely fascinating. But she devoted much of her life, as I said, to the women's movement. She edited Mother Earth. She also, with her lover Alexander Berkman, became the center of the anti-draft movement during the First World War. Eventually is actually put on a boat and deported from the U.S. In that Red Scare period. Another very black period in our history. In fact, the laws passed in 1919 during the Red Scare are very much like the Patriot Act that we are going through now. But she's an amazingly important figure who's inspired many people. Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker, regarded her as one of the great people of the world. And there were victories. The Wobblies had some very important victories. The best known is this struggle in Lawrence, Massachusetts, in 1910. What had happened was that about 1910. But what had happened was a state law was passed reducing the work week from 58 to 54 hours a week. Imagine, 58 to 54. But the law said there should be no pay taken from your envelope as a result of this. But the women at their machines in Lawrence and Lowell got their pay envelopes, and as you can guess, money had been taken out. So they sat at their machines and they chanted, "Short pay, short pay, short pay." And they went out on strike, and the men and women in other factories in the area joined them in the famous Lawrence strike of 1912. I said 10, it should be 1912. Again, the organizing that went into this, they gathered their children together, put them on trains, and sent them to New York to stay with relatives for safekeeping. And when their children got to New York, of course, they had a huge parade down Broadway that brought the strike to the attention of artists and poets and all kinds of other people. And they eventually won the strike. It was one of the great victories for the Wobblies, the IWW, even though they had arrested their leaders, the old trick, you know, they tried to provoke the people to violence, but the people remained nonviolent. They would not respond in kind. And they eventually won the strike. And out of it, as with all so many of these incidents, out of it came poems, essays, short stories, and this wonderful, what was a poem by James Oppenheim called Bread and Roses. You probably know it as a song. But this is, again, there. I have a whole book called An Energy Field More Intense Than War, The Nonviolent Tradition in American Literature. And all throughout our history, we have all these marvelous works of literature and sermons and so on that are all part of this history. I especially love the third stanza of this. As we come marching, marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing their ancient cry for bread. Small art and love and beauty, their drudging spirits knew. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. Ogunquit, I hope you know the great bakery in Ogunquit, Maine, called the Bread and Roses Bakery. Go there. Not just for the painting, for the goodies. Other figures, again, very important in this period. We're moving now close to the First World War. And this is Jane Addams, who would become a major figure in resistance to war making in Europe. She would eventually receive the Nobel Prize for Peace in the 1930s, but not before she had been vilified for opposing U.S. entrance into World War I. The other strong advocates against the war included Eugene Victor Debs, shown here, head of the Socialist Party, speaking in Canton, Ohio, to a group of draft resistors who were in prison. The Socialist Party was completely opposed to the war, to the First World War. They said, why should workers go from the U.S. To Europe to kill other workers? Our struggle is right here at home. Better wages, better working conditions. And of course, he was warned against this, and eventually, sure enough, was brought to trial and sentenced to Atlanta Federal Prison. Here's what he told the judge before they carted him off to jail. While there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. While there is a soul in prison, I am not free. This is Ben Shahn's painting, by the way. He was 63. Debs was 63 at the time. He went to federal prison and was kept there very viciously by Woodrow Wilson and not released until 1921. While he was in prison, he was nominated for president on the socialist ticket for the fifth time and received over 1 million votes for president while he was in Atlanta federal prison. That's, he's just accepted the nomination there with the roses. But the First World War also brought on a very, very savage, repressive time in the Red Scare of 1919 and afterward that actually crushed the labor movement and also destroyed the socialist movement. And here are two of the victims of that repressive initiative came out of the Attorney General's office in Washington. This is Sacco and Vanzetti. A fish peddler and a shoemaker, anarchists who were arrested on charges of robbery and of killing someone. The evidence was never convincing against them. In fact, the state of Massachusetts said they weren't guilty in 1976. But they were put in prison and held there for 7 years and eventually executed by the state of Massachusetts, but not before there were huge protests all over the country involving people like Edna St. Vincent Millay and Catherine Ann Porter and John Del Paso, shown here, who tells the story of this and of the movement generally in his great trilogy called USA. He's been being carted off to jail in Boston. In the 1930s, a great period for nonviolence. This is a sit-in in Flint, Michigan, members of the United Auto Workers. They were told initially that they could organize and not be fired, but when they tried to organize, they lost their jobs. So instead of going outside to picket, they simply sat down inside the factory and refused to move. And the good side of this, they won the strike. And they remained there. Their families brought them food and blankets and so on, and they wrote pamphlets and they wrote poems and so on. And eventually, even the governor of the state came to their side. So this is 1935, and the many, many labor struggles of the 30s, of course, are central to this history, because it was sometimes workers who experimented with various strategies for nonviolence, like the sit-in strike, which, of course, has been very important. One of the most amazing things to happen in the 30s was the founding of the Catholic worker movement. 1933, December 1st, in New York, at Union Square, people began handing out a newspaper, 1,500 copies of something called The Catholic Worker. It was co-founded by Dorothy Day, a woman who'd been born in Brooklyn in 1897, gone to school at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, and then went to New York to work for various radical newspapers during the period of the First World War. There's so many marvelous things to say about her, but she was arrested. Here, another person who was arrested and put in jail and then was very radicalized by the experience because she was just visiting some of her friends in Chicago, and they threw her in jail, and she saw the conditions of the people in jail. And then, until the end of her life, 1980, she devoted herself to the poor and founded Catholic worker houses. There are now 150 of them throughout the world, where people are fed. In Catholic Worker House in Los Angeles, they feed 1,500 street people a day. We're very blessed in Worcester. We have three Catholic Worker Houses. There's a great one in Hartford. And so this is the woman with her friend Peter Morin, who helped to initiate that movement. And really, they didn't know what to do with it, the established church, the institutional church. But she'll probably be canonized someday. You know, that often happens. Here she is leading a demonstration against nuclear weapons and the stupid air raid drills that were called in the 1950s, calling against for an end to the making of all nuclear weapons. Right behind her is Ammon Hennessy, who was a draft resister during the First World War, became an associate editor of the Catholic Worker, was jailed 32 times for protesting capital punishment and nuclear weapons. I recommend his book, especially the Book of Ammon, a really great man from whom I learned much of what I'm saying here. He stayed at our house, as did Dorothy Day, And they were both, well, it was just amazing. You know, you're just walking history books, not in any academic or pretentious way, but they were just, their lives so rich and so much a part of this. Here's what Ammon wrote in 1945. He and Dorothy Day never paid income tax, never filed income tax forms. He said, any money that you pay to the state automatically goes to kill, for weapons. So Ammon, one day in 45, after a day in the field, wrote this, which is a wonderful sort of synopsis of nonviolence. Love without courage and wisdom is sentimentality, as with the ordinary church member. Courage without love and wisdom is foolhardiness, as with the ordinary soldier. Wisdom without love and courage is cowardice, as with the ordinary intellectual. So much for college teachers, right? Therefore, one with love, courage, and wisdom is one in a million who moves the world, as with Jesus, Buddha, and Gandhi. The Journey of Reconciliation, 1947, a law had been passed saying that there should be no discrimination at anything governed by interstate commerce, meaning that any restaurants train stations or bus stations, black people should be served. And so these people, Wally Nelson, I'm sure many of you know, many other people from American Friends Service Committee, Fellowship of Reconciliation, and so on, went on this trip. And they went to the lunch counters at the various bus and train stations. And of course, they were arrested and put on chain gangs when they got to the South because black people would not be served. So the law wasn't being obeyed, in other words. And the freedom rides, which this was the first, became, of course, extremely important later in the civil rights movement. But these were the people who charted the way. You see, experiments with truth. They're testing nonviolence. How far can you go? What can you do? 1955, this should be, although there's again so much history to be told, and I'm sure that you know some of it through the great series called Eyes on the Prize. But an important incident on December 1st, 1955, when a woman by the name of Rosa Parks in Montgomery, Alabama, she was a secretary for the NAACP. She got on the bus that day, and by state law, she was to give up her seat for any white man or any white person who got on the bus. She said, no. She said, today I'm not standing up. I will not be moved. People said, well, now, why did you decide that? And she said, well, it was December 1st, and I'd been working very hard. I was a seamstress, and I was tired. Of course, there was a lot more to it than that. She was an amazing person, as you know, and this was really this ignited a tremendously powerful movement in Montgomery, where black people refused to travel on the buses for a full year, but eventually they were integrated. And many other things. It's so interesting how one thing will bring on another. It happened that there was a young minister who just moved to town, Montgomery, Alabama. He and his wife and young family, and he was at the Drexel Avenue Baptist Church within the shadow of the state capitol. And they started the Montgomery Improvement Association, and they approached him and said, will you be the head of this? And initially he said no. Then he said yes, and that was, of course, Martin Luther King, who from 55 then emerged until he was murdered in 1968 as a primary voice of the civil rights movement. Not to take anything away from him, but there were so many remarkable people who were part of that movement, the students who were arrested, thousands of people arrested, several people killed, thousands jailed, and so on. For example, this is then Birmingham, Alabama, later in 1963. Out of this experience, King is jailed and wrote what is maybe the most important document in this history is the letter from Birmingham Jail. It's a brilliant essay, a classic work in English now and in all the anthologies, but an amazing piece of writing addressed to his colleagues, really, the ministers who said he was causing trouble by starting these demonstrations. He said, what? He said, I usually don't answer these things, You're telling me I'm causing trouble by trying to correct an injustice in the most segregated city in the United States? I'm the troublemaker? He said, wait a minute, didn't you read St. Augustine? And didn't you read, you and I went to seminary together. We read these documents. You know what I'm doing, or you should know. It's an amazing piece of work. And there were, so many amazing students. I was teaching at an all-black college in Durham, North Carolina at that time. This is 1963. This is in Greensboro, actually. And students, black and white students, would go and sit in at lunch counters and demand that the black students be served. And they wouldn't serve them. They just stayed there. They would not be moved. And people came and yelled insults at them, poured mustard and ketchup and sugar, insulted them. They remained nonviolent. And I think the important thing to say is they won. The civil rights movement, thanks to many people, and here is an indication of the tradition again. Martin Luther King had read Gandhi. Gandhi had read Tolstoy, who knew of Aidan Ballou. So this whole history, but he's the great figure in our history because he brought it all to life again, which led then to a number of other movements in the 60s, such as the San Francisco to Moscow Peace Walk, United Farm Workers, workers previously not even represented, not organized, but through the work of a great woman by the name of Dolores Huerta, who's still living, and also, of course, Cesar Chavez, the United Farm Workers, which he emerges as one of the great figures in this history as well. So, as I said, there's much more to talk about, and I'm really summarizing very quickly in this later period to bring it up to the present. This is 1965. Dave Dillinger, Stoughton Lind, and John Lewis in one of the first major demonstrations against the war in Vietnam. All of these people, each of these slides is a book, actually, but I can only mention them. An important dimension of this, the writings of Thomas Merton in Gethsemane, Kentucky, in a monastery, but is writing and challenging the Catholic population as well, which had initially supported the war in Vietnam. He said anybody who pretends to be a Christian would be opposed not only to segregation, but also to nuclear weapons. And his influence became considerable, especially among the religious community. 1967, the March on Washington. Hundreds of thousands of people. Again, the troops come out, try to provoke the people to violence. They remain nonviolent. People like Irene Johnson and a number of Quakers went to prison, take their clothes taken away from them, everything, and a lot of other people suffered. 1968, just the next spring, Daniel and Philip Berrigan and seven other men and women go and burn draft files in Catonsville, Maryland. That's Daniel Berrigan on the right, a Jesuit priest who, of course, is living and is the author of some 75 books and winner of many awards for poetry and for his great play called The Trial of the Catonsville Nine. Philip Berrigan is the fourth from the right, Tom Lewis, Marjorie, and Tom Melville. They burned the draft files, stayed there and prayed, were arrested, and eventually spent 2 years in prison for their civil disobedience. But as part of this whole effort of building an anti-war movement, performing Daniel's play called The Trial of the Catonsville Nine, which was produced in 30 countries throughout the world and became very important to organizing against the war. And the other thing that was important there in that slide, you notice this quotation from Philip. When he goes to testify in the trial, he says, from the Boston Tea Party through the abolitionist and anarchist movements, right up to the present, we have this rich tradition of civil disobedience. So though he and Daniel were the first Catholic priests to be arrested for civil disobedience, he knew very well the tradition within which he was acting. The poets against the war in Vietnam, Allen Ginsberg committing civil disobedience, has a marvelous statement about refusing to pay your taxes. Closer to our own time, the various plowshares actions. Again, Philip Berrigan and others going into weapons manufacturers, going into bases at Griffiths Air Force Base that are sending nuclear weapons to England, pouring blood, unfurling banners, being arrested. This is Elizabeth McAllister, the wife of Philip Berrigan, speaking at the Pentagon. She will spend 3 years in Atlanta Federal Prison. Alderson Federal Prison, which is the women's prison, for her effort to stop the deployment of nuclear weapons. At the present, I think one would have to say a major element in this nonviolent movement that's sustaining it and continuing it is the effort to close the School of Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, initiated by Father Roy Bourgeois, who had been in the Vietnam War, met a priest who was taking care of orphans, came back, studied for the priesthood, went to Latin America to work among the poorest of the poor in Bolivia and in Peru, was eventually kicked out of the country, not allowed to return because he was standing with the disappeared. So he came back and started doing research. Here's where you have the importance of academics and of activists working together, getting the information. He was able to prove that many of the people who were trained at the School of the Americas killed the four American women in El Salvador, murdered Oscar Romero, murdered priests in El Salvador, the Jesuit priests. So we have this really very, very important movement to close the School of Americas, where the U.S. trains many of the death squads and others who have killed so many people in Latin America. I'm happy to say that my congressman, Jim McGovern from Worcester, has been very much at the forefront of the legislative effort to cut off the funding of School of Americas. So the movement is very much alive. This is a very quick sort of history, but just to show that even in the tradition of the arts, here's a new painting of the Peaceable Kingdom. It's called Peaceable Queendom because it's by Willa Bickham Walsh at the Catholic Worker in Baltimore. But it's the same theme that we need to work for that world in which all of nature will live in harmony, that we live without killing, that we live committed to resisting injustice and humiliation, resolving conflict, and bringing about social change without killing. We saw powerful evidence around the world in this massive movement against the war in Iraq. And there are many, many stories, of course, to tell about the great nonviolent movements throughout the rest of the world since the 1980s. But this is simply to suggest that the tradition I'm talking about is probably stronger and richer now than it's ever been, still in tremendous need of many more people working at many levels, people going to jail, people caring for children, the parents who go to jail, all this important work of telling the stories of peacemakers, of people power around the world, with the a strong and rich tradition in the U.S. that we must make available to our children and grandchildren, and also build upon what has been done not only in the U.S., but in other parts of the world for nonviolence.